to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 26th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the five-day forecast for the Siouxland area, and it looks like the first couple of days are going to be cooler, but then it's going to warm up by the weekend. So today is cloudy, windy, and colder with a high of 31 and a low tonight of 15. Wednesday will be not as quite as cold with some sun, with a high of 45 and a low of 21. Thursday is going to be partly sunny and warmer with a high of 62 and a low of 38. Friday will also be partly sunny and it will be hot, nice with a high of 63 and a low of 35. And then Saturday is going to be partly sunny with a high of 57 and a low of 36. Our first front page story is concerning the retirement of the fire chief, Tom Everett. After a 31-year career with the Sioux City Fire Department, Fire Chief Tom Everett is hanging up his fireman's helmet for good. "Chiefs don't ever get to get their helmets dirty," Everett joked as he walked from his office on a recent Thursday morning down the hallway at Sioux City Fire Rescue Headquarters to a row of black, red, and white helmets hanging vertically on a wall. Everett has worn one each as fireman, lieutenant, captain, and chief. Everett isn't planning on retiring until early September, but he said he had to make the announcement 5 months out so the city could begin the lengthy process of finding his successor. "I think that the department is in a good spot for it," Everett said of his retirement. "We had tons of large initiatives that I feel like we're in between, so it's just a good time for somebody else to pick up and run with it. And frankly, I've accomplished kind of what I set out to accomplish." When Everett was very young, his family moved across the Missouri River to South Sioux City. After graduating from South Sioux City High School, he joined the Navy and became an airman. "I had some friends who left the Navy and got on fire departments in different places. One in particular got on in Baltimore, Maryland, and was telling me about the shift work and the way that they work in teams, similar to what we did on the flight deck," said Everett, who said camaraderie, having a clear mission and purpose, and operating in a paramilitary chain of command are also aspects of firefighting that appealed to him. "It fit in with exactly what I was looking to do at the time." The Sioux City's fire department hired Everett in 1993. He said it was a goal early on in his career to be promoted to lieutenant, which he said happened fairly fast. "And once I got to lieutenant, I thought, boy, I would really like to run a station," said Everett, who ended up becoming a captain relatively quickly as well. "From there, my goal was really to make the next rank, which was assistant chief, and run a shift. There just wasn't any opportunity for that. Positions were filled, and the people were there for a long time." Everett was a 15-year veteran of the fire department and a captain heading Fire Station 7 when he took the reins as chief in October 2008. He replaced Greg Martin, who accepted the chief's job in Rochester, Minnesota. Retired Chief Bob Hamilton ran the department until City Manager Paul Eckert selected Everett from among 8 finalists. "During his testing process, captains were not allowed to test for chief," Everett said of Martin. "The second time, after he left, they were allowed. So I put in for this position and was fortunate enough to be chosen by then City Manager Paul Eckert." Everett said his goals coming into the job included accrediting the department and improving its Insurance Service Office, ISO, fire rating, which is a score given to fire departments and insurance companies by the Insurance Services Office. ISO ratings drive the cost of homeowners insurance premiums in an area. "We achieved the first Class 2 in the state of Iowa, and then we achieved the first Class 1 in the state of Iowa," he said. "It just helps with the insurance costs for all the citizens out there. We were able to make some adjustments in the way that we operate, particularly training-wise, and we were able to improve those scores. They're fairly rare scores. ISO Class 1 is not something that's very typical out there." Moving the department's training center was also a priority for Everett. "At the time, we had a training center on 18th Street that was pretty dated, in very rough shape, and a lot of repair money every year for the roads and the building there," he said. "I saw an opportunity with the old recycling center for us to kind of take that over and do that. We did that right away. We made a lot of improvements, and just recently, we finally built the new training tower there. Everett said he enjoys the challenges of being chief, but does miss being out on the street and in the fire station. People think of the fire chief like you're out there at the fire pointing your fingers and kind of running things operationally, he said. Here in Sioux City, with this kind of a department, our assistant chiefs run the day-to-day emergency activities. Fire chief is largely administrative, so a lot of my time is hiring and budget, personnel things, not the exciting stuff that they see on TV. When I would be in charge of an emergency situation, it is if it's a very large, multi-jurisdiction thing like the 2011 floods or something like that. Reflecting on his career, Everett said the big blazes aren't the cause that stand out in his mind. The 2001 slaying of Leticia Aguilar and her five children in their home at 311 West Street is a tragedy that sticks with Everett. The things that stand out in my mind tend to be some that are more violent and not necessarily good memory type things. The West Street murders, suicides, things like that, he said. When you're driving around the city and you go by a house or a particular intersection or something, it just kind of makes you remember that. Everett also has a lot of good memories of working with the crew to put out fires. When it comes to retirement, Everett said he doesn't really have any plans. He will stay in Sioux City and travel a bit. I'm just looking forward to slowing down, spending some more time with my family. I have two kids that live out of town, so being able to visit them a little bit more, he said. Police to seek grant for license plate cameras. The Sioux City Council, by voting in favor of its consent agenda Monday, authorized the police department to submit an application for grant funding for a flock safety license plate recognition camera system. The Woodbury County Sheriff's Department and the Sioux City DEA Drug Task Force are partnering with the police department on the grant application to the State of Iowa Office of Drug Control Policy Burn Justice Assistant Grant Program for the License Plate Recognition or Reader System. The amount being requested is $126,650. The cameras do not detect motorists who are speeding or running red lights, but act as a crime-fighting tool for law enforcement officers. They capture high-resolution images of the backs of vehicles and license plate data. They're using them for more than what is being said here, and that concerns me, Mayor Bob Scott said of the cameras. I think we have enough people watching over us. I'm not some conspiracy guy that worries about everything, but I don't want to overreach on the part of the government either. I don't think that's fair to the citizens. If the grant is awarded, it would fund the initial setup of the 32-camera system and be used from July 1, 2024, through June 30, 2025. The system's hardware would be owned and maintained by Flock Safety. Sioux City Police Captain Ryan Bertrand told the council about how effective Flock Safety system has been in South Sioux City in tracking suspects involved in major crimes, including homicide. When we can't be in a place, the camera's there 24/7. It doesn't get tired. It doesn't need a break. It just keeps generating information for us, Bertrand said. Bertrand said leveraging such technology in Sioux City would be a great thing for the citizens. Beth Shalom, the Jewish synagogue, recently had a suspicious activity call at their place. They have a license plate reader system. They called to make a complaint of the suspicious activity. They had the suspect vehicle identified in a matter of minutes, he said. In our next story, defense wants quadruple homicide trial moved from Cedar County, Hartington, Nebraska. Potential jurors referred to Jason Jones as a fruitcake, nut job, psychopath, and scumbag. In a questionnaire sent to a 200-person jury pool, nearly 70% of respondents said they believe Jones is guilty, and many said he deserves the death penalty if found guilty of the August 2022 fatal shootings of four people in Laurel, Nebraska. Because of those results and the extensive media attention the quadruple homicide has received, Jones' attorney said his murder trial should be moved from Cedar County because it would be nearly impossible to seat an impartial jury to guarantee Jones a fair trial there. His attorney, Todd Lancaster, said in his motion for change of venue, which was filed Friday, the pre-trial publicity, and the responses to the supplemental jury questionnaires show a pattern of deep and bitter prejudice in Cedar County against Mr. Jones. Jones, 44, has pleaded not guilty to 4 counts each of first-degree murder and use of a firearm to commit a felony, and 2 counts of first-degree arson. He is charged with the August 4, 2022, shooting deaths of Michelle Eberling, 53, in her home, and Gene Twyford, 86, his wife Janet, 85, and their daughter Dana, 55, in their home, and setting both houses on fire. Jones' wife, Carrie, 44, has pleaded not guilty of first-degree murder, tampering with physical evidence, and being an accessory to a felony. She is accused of aiding and abetting the death of Gene Twyford. Trial dates have not yet been set for the two, who will be tried separately. Prosecutors have filed notice they would seek the death penalty for Jason Jones if he is found guilty of first-degree murder. District Judge Brian Meismer will consider the change of venue request and other issues at a Thursday hearing in Cedar County District Court. He also will hear pre-trial motions in Carrie Jones' case. Lancaster's filing for change of venue was expected. In February, Meismer granted Lancaster's request to send questionnaires to the jury pool, and the results were provided to the defense and the prosecution on March 13th. In his motion, Lancaster said 33 of the 200 jurors had Laurel addresses, including one across the street from one of the crime scenes, and 52 of them knew either the Twyfords or the Twyford family members. When asked if they had an opinion on Jones' guilt or innocence, 139, or 69.5%, said they believed he is guilty, and 87 said they could not set that opinion aside if chosen for the jury. Another 15 said they could set their opinion aside, but Jones would have to prove his innocence rather than the state prove his guilt. When asked about the death penalty, 99 of 200 said they favor it, and 27 said they were against it. Jones should receive the death penalty, 48 of the respondents said. One of the potential jurors said, "He has wasted a lot of taxpayers' money and now might be wasting my time. He should be put to death the same way he killed innocent people by setting the fire." Others made biblical references to an eye for an eye. In addition to the jurors' comments, Lancaster of the Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy in Lincoln said pervasive pretrial publicity, including dozens of stories by Cedar County newspapers, plus coverage by other regional newspapers and television and radio stations, and the availability of all coverage to wide audiences through social media, have included details and statements from law enforcement and potential witnesses that would not be allowed at Jones' trial. Comments in the questionnaire showed many of the jurors have read or heard that information, Lancaster said. The pervasive publicity, which details testimony likely not to be presented at Mr. Jones' trial, shows the only way he can receive a fair and impartial jury is for the venue to be changed to another county. Lancaster made no recommendations for a specific alternate trial location, but said moving the trial to a county with a larger population than Cedar County's 8,262 people would provide a larger juror pool and make choosing a jury easier. Jones was arrested approximately 24 hours after authorities responded to a fire in the early morning hours of August 4, 2022, at 209 Elm Street, where they found Eberling's body with 2 gunshot wounds. A second fire at the Twyford home at 503 Elm Street was reported soon after, and the responders found the family members' bodies, all with gunshot wounds. Jones, who lived across the street from Eberling, was found at his home and airlifted to a Lincoln hospital for treatment of serious burns. He is being held without bond at the Nebraska Department of Corrections Reception and Treatment Center in Lincoln. Investigators found empty .44 caliber shell casings near Eberling's body and a Ruger handgun registered to Jones, plus credit card receipts for gas and gas cans in the Twyford home. Carrie Jones, who was arrested in December of 2022 and remains in custody in the Antelope, Nebraska County Jail, told investigators she had arrived home from work minutes before seeing her badly burned husband emerge from Eberling's home after the fire was spotted. She helped him into their home and put away his handgun, which he had been carrying. Portion of Military Road to Close. Military Road between Castleman and Prescott Streets will close April 1st for utility and paving repairs. The Sioux City Engineering Division said in a statement that a marked detour will reroute all traffic to West 19th Street using Castleman and Ross Streets. The closure will remain in place until the middle of May, depending on the weather, according to the statement. Motorists are advised to reduce speed, drive cautiously, and obey all traffic control signs during the closure. Sioux City man gets 10 years prison for shooting. A Sioux City man has been sentenced to prison for shooting another man in the hand and firing shots at a woman during an unrelated incident. Orlando Hinsman, 26, pleaded guilty in January in Woodbury County District Court to intimidation with a dangerous weapon and willful injury causing serious injury. District Judge Robert Tietenfaller on Monday sentenced Hinsman to 10 years in prison. Hinsman shot Fernando Murillo on October 7th near West 3rd and George Streets while Murillo was walking to work. Murillo told police he saw a handgun pointed out the window of a vehicle slowly advancing toward him, and the driver threatened to rob him. The driver then fired one shot, striking Murillo in the left hand and drove away. Doctors had to remove Murillo's pinky because of the gunshot injury. Police used video surveillance footage from an area business to identify the vehicle and Hinsman. Hinsman also fired two shots at a woman during a verbal altercation on October 18th in the 1500 block of West 20th Street. Shell casings were recovered from both shooting scenes, and tests determined they were fired from the same gun Hinsman had used. Hinsman was ordered to pay restitution to the victims in an amount to be determined. A case charging Hinsman with displaying a gun to a delivery man was earlier dismissed, and he was fined $105 after pleading guilty to disorderly conduct in an alleged domestic assault. Woman pleads guilty of theft from group home residence, Primgar, Iowa. A former administrative assistant at a home for adults with mental illness and disabilities has pleaded guilty of stealing thousands of dollars from residents. Jennifer Storm, 48, of Primgar, entered her plea Monday to two counts of caretaker-dependent adult abuse by exploitation and one count of first-degree theft. Sentencing was scheduled for May 6th in O'Brien County District Court. A plea agreement filed in the case said the sentence will be left to a judge to determine, but prosecutors will recommend a 10-year prison sentence. Storm was arrested in September after an investigation by the state of Iowa's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit uncovered theft from 21 residents at Pride Group in Primgar from November 20, 2020 through March 29, 2023. During that time, Storm was an administrative assistant and was responsible for residents' money. According to court documents, Storm made unauthorized withdrawals on some residents' accounts, used residents' debit cards to make online and in-person purchases for herself, and moved Social Security funds from one resident's accounts to others to cover up thefts. O'Brien County Attorney Michael Becker filed a request for restitution of $45,614 to Pride Group. In exchange for Storm's guilty pleas, Becker will dismiss 8 additional counts of dependent adult abuse and 1 count of ongoing criminal conduct. Fired Iowa Corrections Officer sues state for defamation. A former corrections officer is suing the state of Iowa for allegedly firing him after he was wrongfully accused of sexual relations with an inmate. Jared Eugene Deers of Mahaska County is suing the Ottumwa Residential Correctional Facility, a state-run work treatment facility. Its manager, Ted Robinson, Dan Fell, the director of 8th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections, and corrections employees Lisa Hauk and Nicole Harbison. The lawsuit, which was moved recently from state court to federal court, seeks unspecified damages for defamation, denial of due process, and interference with a contractual relationship. According to the lawsuit, Dyers worked at the Ottumwa Residential Correction Facility as a residential officer from April 2023 until June 2023 when he was fired. Within the few weeks of being hired, Dyers claims, he learned that a rumor was circulating at work that he had been sexually intimate with a male inmate. A co-worker allegedly showed Dyers an image the co-worker had created using photo editing software to depict Dyers in a tuxedo standing next to a male inmate in a wedding dress. Sioux City Council advances SUX development proposal. The Sioux City Council approved a resolution Monday announcing the city's intent to accept a developer's proposal to construct a hotel, convenience store, warehouse, and new housing on a parcel of land at Sioux Gateway's entrance. The vote was 3-0, with Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore abstaining. Councilwoman Julie Shaner was absent from the meeting. Before the vote, Mayor Bob Scott asked city staff for assurance that the land would actually sell. He also asked for a revisionary clause so that people are not just speculating on the land. Midwest Hotels LLC wants to pay the full appraised price of $1.4 million for the northeast parcel of land at Aviation and Discovery Boulevards. At the closing, the land will sell. The hammer goes down. Do we know that for sure? Scott asked. Renee Billings, economic development specialist for the city, told Scott a development agreement would be provided during the May 6th hearing. Economic Development Director Marty Daugherty said the developer would begin and complete the hotel in 18 months. We don't even know the brand of the hotel, Scott said. Those types of things to me are terribly important, and we're not just selling to a land speculator that doesn't have necessarily at the stage of development. Daugherty responded, it's never been our policy to sell city land on speculation. This is critical land to the airport and to the city. We will definitely have benchmarks in any agreement we bring forward. Midwest Hotels LLC's proposal was one of four proposals submitted to the city for the purchase and development of property at the northeast and southeast corners of the airport's entrance. The northeast parcel includes 14.38 acres, and the south parcel includes 7.33 acres. City staff will continue conversations with interested developers regarding that south parcel. Midwest Hotels LLC proposed constructing strip-type commercial on a south parcel, which would have brought its total investment with the hotel, convenience store, and warehouse on the north parcel to $20 to $30 million. The company is also offering to restore a historic World War II-era chapel after it is moved to a new location. The chapel has been vacant for a number of years. The city also received the proposals from Sergeant Bluff Eye Care, Connolly Developments, and Purdue. Sergeant Bluff Eye Care would purchase 4 acres of the north parcel for $174,240 and construct an optometry clinic for a total investment of $3.3 million. Connolly Developments would purchase 14.38 acres, entire north parcel, for the full appraised price of $1.4 million, remodel the existing housing, construct contractor bays for a total investment of $6.82 million, and work to attract a hotel or convenience store for the corner lot for a total additional investment of $4 to $10 million. Purdue would purchase 7.33 acres, which is the south parcel, for $1. Appraised value is $800,000, in exchange for a minimum assessment agreement on the company's adjacent property. The company is currently investing $50 million in facility upgrades to the adjacent property. Purdue would construct a parking lot for overflow truck and or employee parking. The sale of the property will generate revenue for the airport and increase the overall tax base. Iowa Senate okays limits to local stormwater regulations. Counties and cities would be prohibited from adopting regulations stricter than what the state permits for topsoil management at construction sites under legislation that is on its way to Governor Kim Reynolds for her consideration. Iowa Senate Republicans approved the proposal Monday at the Iowa Capitol, giving its final approval in the Iowa legislature. The bill also would restrict the regulations local jurisdictions can place on the stormwater infrastructures required for new developments. Only Republicans voted for the bill as it passed out of the Iowa Senate 29-18. Two Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against the bill. Republicans argued the bill would constrain a local regulation that could drive up the cost of home construction, thus creating more affordable housing options for Iowans. Iowa Senator Scott Webster, a Republican from Bettendorf, who co-owns a home building business, said local regulations like the ones that would be limited by the bill can add thousands of dollars in costs to home construction projects, and he argued those regulations do not effectively make the project safer. Democrats argued that cities and counties should not be restricted by the state when it comes to local regulations, and that stormwater regulations can prevent catastrophic flooding damages to homes. The bill, Senate File 455, previously passed the Iowa House on a 53-46 vote, just days after, on a first attempt, it was defeated in the House on a 49-44 vote. Having now passed the House and the Senate, the proposal heads to Reynolds for her consideration. Now move to the opinion page, and we have some letters to the editor. The first one is from Karen Heidman of Sioux City, and Karen writes, "Iowans expect their legislators to protect the health and safety of citizens. Then, why was a bill to shield chemical companies from lawsuits involving harm to users even written? Why does SF-2412 remain alive in the legislature? Chemical giant Monsanto and Bayer produces the herbicide Roundup, linked for years to cancers among its users. The company, hit by thousands of lawsuits brought by users whose doctors suspect their cancers are caused by Roundup, has sought protection through the Supreme Court. No dice. So now it comes hat in hand to state legislatures seeking the same relief. Iowa and two other states have fallen dutifully into line to help. Thus, the bill still lurks in our capital and could deny thousands of Iowans the funds they need to survive illnesses caused by this product. With no support from Democrats, its GOP supporters have ignored these red flags. Germany, home of this chemical giant, recently banned Roundup. Iowa is second in the nation for Roundup use. Iowa ranks in the top five states for rates of blood cancers like leukemia and lymphoma, to which Roundup has been consistently linked. If this bill becomes law, a wide swath of Iowans will lose the right to seek relief from staggering medical costs associated with the use of this herbicide, not just farmers and farm laborers, but also landscapers, gardeners, and anyone else who consistently uses this product. Please tell your legislators to protect constituents, not chemical giants." And again, this was written by Karen Heidman of Sioux City. Our next one is written by Michael Maxwell of Sioux City. "For those who still insist they do not know any queer people, I'm here to tell you that you are mistaken. If you think that you don't have a relationship with a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or non-binary individual, what that actually means is that the queer people in your life are not comfortable being themselves around you. I've grown tired of my existence being treated as pornography. Our presence in public spaces, in books, and on your television is not obscene. I ask you to question what the logical endgame of the current slate of anti-LGBTQ+ legislation in the state is. When you vote for our elected officials, I also ask you to consider whether they will use their platform to address the tough issues Iowa faces, issues which require actual hard work and consensus building, or if they just want to use their newfound strength to bully the minority of the week in hopes of landing a talking head gig on cable news. It is also time to recognize the contributions queer Iowans make to our state's economy and culture. If you want to attract fresh talent to our state, let alone retain the talent we have, then Iowa must be a safe place for this talent to live. Companies will not invest in sending employees to a state in which many of them will be discriminated against. Gay bashing is bad for everyone, and it feels ridiculous to have to still point this out in 2024. You can't unring a bell." And again, this was written by Michael Maxwell of Sioux City. And then our last letter is written by Donald C. Parsons from Sioux City. And he writes, "We need our local newspaper in Sioux City now more than ever. They say that when you lose your local newspaper, you lose the watchdog on local government. On page 8-5 of last Thursday's paper, there was an article entitled, Sioux City Denies FOIA, F-O-I-A, Request Concerning Inclusion Liaison Suspension. The article states, days after an internal memo was leaked to the journal, great reporting. The whistleblower city employee sick of the incompetence has someone to go to, the journal. The city gives no response, just like the county can't even tell us when the jail will open and who is going to pay for each and every mistake that has been made. Now we have the city saying it wants to build a new wastewater treatment plant at a cost of who knows how many million dollars. I'm not saying that the journal is getting the answers, but at least they are asking the questions. So when the politicians refuse to answer those questions and refuse to be held accountable, we can go to the ballot box and tell them what we think of them. Social media is not the answer to good journalism. And again, this was written by Donald C. Parsons of Sioux City. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. Barbara E. Deedy, and that's spelled D-I-E-D-E, 78, of Hinton, passed away on Saturday, March 23rd at a Sergeant Bluff care facility. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, March 29th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be 1 hour prior at the funeral home. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Barbara was born on August 7, 1945 in Sioux City to Richard Stan and Evelyn Hay Juzek. She attended school in Leeds through her junior year and graduated her senior year from Riverside High School in 1963. On September 7, 1963, she married Lloyd Deedy in Elk Point, South Dakota. To this union, two children were born, Valerie and Martin. Barbara worked for various companies, including Windcharger, Zenith, and IBP, where she worked from 1980 until 1996 until retirement. Following retirement, Barbara and Lloyd moved from Sioux City to rural Hinton, where they have lived since 1998. In her free time, Barbara spent time cross-stitching, traveling to the family's cabin in northern Minnesota, where she spent many hours fishing, and watching the Iowa Hawkeyes basketball and football games. She enjoyed many hockey trips, attending family gatherings, and spending time with her beloved cats. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be donated to Hospice of St. Croix. The family would like to extend a special thank you to Hospice of St. Croix and Barbara's nurse, Whitney, for their loving care. Brian Eugene Queen, 56, of Sioux City, died March 24th. Funeral service will be 10 a.m. Wednesday, March 27th at Cornerstone World Outreach Church. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Tuesday at the Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Thomas R. Havilar, 79, of South Sioux City, passed away Friday, March 22nd. A memorial visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 28th at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. LaVon E. Ferguson, age 100, of North Sioux City, passed away March 18th. Visitation will be at the Christy Smith Larkin Chapel from 1 to 4 p.m. May 11th. Private family burial will be at Logan Park Cemetery. We'll now move to a health-related story. Report blames alcohol for Iowa's cancer crisis. Iowa has second highest, fastest rising cancer incidence. Amid increasing scrutiny of a potential link between Iowa farm chemicals and cancer, a new report is generating controversy as it blames rising cancer rates not on the toxins used widely throughout the state, but on something else entirely: binge alcohol consumption. The Iowa Cancer Registry, a health research group housed at the University of Iowa, reported on February 20th that Iowa has the second highest and fastest rising incidence of cancer among all states. An estimated 21,000 new cancer cases are expected to develop this year, and 6,100 Iowans will die from cancer, Iowa Cancer Registry Director Mary Charlton said in announcing the new report. Iowa, she said, has the highest rate of binge drinking in the Midwest, with 22% of residents reporting binge drinking, more than the national average of 17%. Overall, Iowa has the fourth highest incidence of alcohol-related cancers in the United States. Alcohol is a known carcinogen and a risk factor for several cancers, including oral cavity, pharynx, larynx, esophagus, rectum, liver, and female breast cancers, Charlton said in a news conference. The assessment has drawn questions and sparked doubts, however, from state leaders and health and environment researchers who have been calling for a probe into just how much the state's agriculture industry may be contributing to the spread of the disease. Is alcohol responsible for the increase in cancer incidence here since 2014? I personally doubt that, said James Merchant, a retired professor of occupational environmental health and a former dean of the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Merchant said, what needs to be looked at are things that are probable or possible carcinogens that have increased beginning about 1990 because of the well-recognized latency of environmental cancers. Those carcinogens associated with industrial agriculture are the ones that really need to be looked at very closely. Iowa is the leading U.S. corn and soybean growing state, with millions of acres devoted to the crops. Corn and soybean farmers typically make heavy use of pesticides and fertilizers on their fields. Iowa farms use more weed killers and apply more commercial fertilizer every year than any other state, according to state and federal data. The chemicals are known to contaminate both soil and water and leave pesticide residue in the harvested grains. Researchers have long suspected that exposure to a number of those most popular pesticides may cause human cancers. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC, classified glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, as probable carcinogenic to humans. Other studies have found that exposure to other common pesticides are associated with cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, brain, and prostate cancer. Iowa's sprawling livestock and poultry sector is also a concern. The Iowa operations produce more animal manure every year than any other state, according to federal and state data. Since 1992, for instance, the state's hog population has grown to 24 million hogs, up more than 70%. Iowa's manure production in total has increased almost 80% since 2002, according to the latest U.S. agriculture census. The manure from the animals contributes to the creation of nitrates, which form when nitrogen from fertilizer and manure combines with oxygen. The waste streams routinely drain from farm fields into groundwater, streams, and rivers, contaminating water sources. Babies can suffer severe health problems when consuming nitrates in drinking water, and a growing body of literature indicates potential associations that include an increased risk of cancer. An exposure to elevated levels of nitrates in drinking water from commercial fertilizer and manure has been linked by numerous researchers to cancers of the blood, brain, breast, bladder, and ovaries. David Quirnaty, professor of civil and environmental engineering and director for the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa, recently started working with the Cancer Registry to explore potential environmental factors contributing to Iowa's cancer rates. He noted that multiple risk factors could be contributing to the problem in Iowa, including nitrate exposure. Research studies show that's especially the case with colorectal cancer, ranked 8th in incidence among all states, and breast cancer ranked 9th. We're unique in terms of our production system here, unrivaled anywhere in the world, right? Said Quirnaty. We're proud to boast about that, but we shouldn't be so foolish as to think that the unrivaled scale of production doesn't come with very unique consequences or challenges for our state. The new registry findings, focusing on alcohol consumption and not agriculture chemicals, come as public interest in cancer has swelled across the Corn Belt. Legislation to invest more state funds in research that identifies environmental sources of cancer has been introduced in Iowa as well as Nebraska. In Minnesota, legislators are proposing to introduce a sales tax on commercial fertilizers to pay for closing drinking wells contaminated with nitrates and supplying thousands of southeast Minnesota residents with clean sources of water. The U.S. EPA ordered Minnesota to halt nitrate contamination in groundwater last November. Alcohol consumption is a known risk factor for certain cancers. Nearly 4% of cancers diagnosed worldwide in 2020 can be attributed to alcohol consumption, according to the World Health Organization. In the United States alone, about 75,000 cancer cases and 19,000 cancer deaths are estimated to be linked to alcohol each year. Alcoholic drinks contain ethanol, which is a known carcinogen, according to the National Cancer Institute. And yet, linking alcohol to rising cancer rates in Iowa seems questionable given some of the data points. Iowa's per capita consumption of alcohol ranks 24th in the nation, according to Statista, a data research service. Drinking habits in Iowa do not appear to have changed dramatically in the last few decades, though about a fifth of those who drink alcohol in Iowa identify as binge drinkers, 5 drinks at a sitting for men, 4 for women. Iowa's binge drinkers don't appear to be drinking more heavily now than years ago. On average, Iowa's binge drinkers consume 586 drinks a year in 2017, the latest year for data, 6 more than in 2011. Iowa was one of the 39 states where binge drinkers did not change significantly during that period, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Nationally, rates of alcohol consumption and cancer have diverged. Per capita consumption of alcohol in the United States increased to 2.51 gallons annually in 2021, 17% more than in 1999, according to federal figures. But the national rate of cancer incidence declined 16% during that period, according to the CDC. Iowa's increase in cancer incidence appears to have started around 2012, according to the CDC and the Iowa Cancer Registry. That rise in incidence occurs about 20 years, the scientifically accepted cancer latency period, after the start of Iowa's rapid industrialization in farming. Having a high cancer rate does not immediately translate to its being caused by industrial agriculture, although I think there is just a strong reason to look very hard in that direction, said Merchant. They want to be very, very sure of the ground they stand on, given the power politics in this state. Everybody understands that. My view is that shouldn't keep you from asking the question, and those questions need to be asked. Public confirmation last year of Iowa's high cancer incidence also converged with what most adult Iowans already knew in private. Cancer is everywhere in Iowa. Among the 25 counties in the United States with the highest incidence of cancer, Iowa's Palo Alto County ranks second. Roughly 21,000 Iowans now develop cancer in Iowa annually. That's more than twice as many cancers as occurred in 1973 in a state where the current population, 3.2 million, is a mere 11% higher than it was 50 years ago. Democrats in the State House and Senate proposed legislation this year to increase funding for health studies aimed at definitively identifying the sources of malignancy. State Senator Janice Wiener, who proposed a bill in January to invest $5.25 million for research on pediatric and other cancers to stem what she called Iowa's cancer crisis, said, "We need to make this statement, given the rising cancer rates here and our number two rate in the country. She said, "I have colleagues on the House side who have filed similar legislation that has bipartisan support, so I'm hoping it will move forward. We have a serious problem in Iowa. We owe it to Iowans not to whitewash anything, but to approach it scientifically and get to the bottom of this, wherever research and clinical tests lead us." We'll now move to the sports section, and our first story is about the USA Hockey High School National Championship. Sioux City Metros capture national crown. A national championship trophy is coming home to Sioux City. With a 5-2 victory over East Islip New York Chiefs Sunday, the Sioux City Metros earned the USA Hockey Division II National Championship. "Getting there and winning that game is a great feeling," said senior defenseman Grant Harder. "Being able to celebrate after the game was absolutely electric. This team is my family, and after we game, we saw the video of everyone watching at Peace Pizza in Dakota Dunes, and that meant so much to us. We love that we get to bring home a national championship for them." The sides were even at 2-2 heading into the third period before Carson Fitch scored what ultimately amounted to the game winner. Fitch scored on a Sioux City power play with 3 minutes 46 seconds left in the final period, assisted by Tegan Duhlman. Nate Solman, the Metro's all-time leading scorer, added a goal less than 15 seconds later on a Harder assist. And just for good measure, Fitch added an empty netter on a Solman assist with just over a minute remaining. Harder said, When we need scoring, we get it. But my role on this team is to get stops. It's what me and the rest of the defense is there for. It's our job to keep it as low scoring as possible. At the end of the day, we have about 70,000 people in our area, and we go against teams that play in cities that draw from millions of people. When you're out there on the ice, it doesn't matter where you're from. You just have to put in the time and work hard. It all starts with the leadership. The Metros, comprised of players from several local high schools, won a team record 28 games against just 4 losses this season to capture the Midwest High School Hockey League regular season title and then took 3rd at the state tournament prior to the Nationals. Sioux City finished 6-0 at the 5-day tournament in Westchester, Pennsylvania to bring home its first national tournament since 2018. The Metros fell behind 1-0 Sunday after East Islip's Anthony Mazzarita scored an unassisted power play goal with 13:37 left in the first period at Ice Line Arena in Westchester, Pennsylvania. In these types of games, you will and should have some lead changes, said Sioux City head coach Jesse Monell. You have 2 high-caliber clubs that aren't used to losing, so you just have to play all 3 periods. We just kept our composure and kept playing. The Metros got an equalizer with 1:50 left in the second, when Noah Graham assisted a Hunter Ector goal after Sioux City killed a 2-minute East Islip power play early in the frame. 20 seconds after the Ector score, Tegan Dolman put Sioux City up 2-1 on a goal assisted by Charles Egdorf. That lead was short-lived, however, as the Chiefs evened it at 2 when Brian Slattery scored with 1:33 left in the second with an unassisted score. Sioux City again killed an East Islip power play after 2-minute roughing minor was called against the Metro's Caden Patrick at the 8:57 mark in the third. The Chiefs weren't as successful playing shorthanded as a 2-minute tripping minor that went against Christopher Lawler gave Sioux City an opening for Fitch to put the Metros ahead for good. Sioux City took 36 shots to East Islip's 28. In the 6 games at National, Soma had 10 goals to tie East Islip's Ryan Anatra for most at the tournament. For his career with the Metros, Soma scored over 100 goals. All through the season, we've had great leadership from our captains, Nate Soma, Grant Harder, Caden Patrick, and Cash Frigg, Monell said. One of the things about going into this weekend all season long, really, is they brought into leading by effort. It's not so much about the talent or the fancy play, but about effort and how hard they skate. Once they play their game by effort and not by skill, that just molds a championship club. Cameron Patrick was superb in goals for the Metros in stopping the vast majority of those East Islip shots. Cameron Patrick was a key figure in Sioux City's success throughout the season, and especially at the national tournament, as the Metros outscored opponents 43-8 over their 6 games at Nationals. The Sioux City netminder even stopped an East Islip penalty shot with 1:21 left in the third to preserve a 4-2 Metros lead. If your skill guys show they're willing to take a puck to the face or take a hard hit along the boards but still skate with maximum effort, you've got a championship caliber team, Monell said. That was on display this weekend, and I'm just really excited to give these kids this opportunity. I've been with this program since 1980, and we're a small community, but since we started Siouxland hockey in the 1970s, we've competed against the Des Moines and Omahas and have the most championships out of any team in our league. We've won 8 state tournaments and 2 national titles. That's quite amazing. It takes great leadership from our board, our coaching staff, and our players. We've got really great people within our organization. And now we'll continue with the hockey stories with the Sioux City Musketeers. The Sioux City Musketeers dropped a pair of road games to the Muskegon Lumberjacks last weekend. Muskegon edged the Muskies 3-2 on Friday night and followed up with a 6-3 win on Saturday. The losses dropped Sioux City to 31-26-0 on the season. The Muskies, who clinched a spot in the Clark Cup playoffs last weekend, remain in second place in the USHL Western Division, just a point ahead of third place Waterloo. Fargo leads the West with a 45-9-2-0 record. Sioux City is battling with Waterloo for the second first-round bye in the division for next month's playoffs. With their win Saturday, Muskegon also clinched a spot in the playoffs. Sasha Broisvert and Joe Connor both connected for first-period goals, and at the end of 20 minutes of play, the Lumberjacks had a 2-0 lead. Matt Vigridden scored at 2:01 of the second as the lead grew to 3-0. Riley Bruick's first goal of the year for the Muskies made it a 3-1 game, but Gridden scored his second of the game 2 minutes later as Muskegon regained his 3-goal advantage. Bruick's second goal of the game came at 6:24 of the third. After Giacomo Martino tallied at 9:31, the Musketeers pulled within one. The Lumberjacks secured the win when Justin Solovey scored a power play marker at 11:42 and Broisvert tallied into an empty net at 18:36. In Friday's game, Broisvert staked the Lumberjacks to a 1-0 lead when he scored at 31 of the second period. Colin Kessler's deflection on a shot from Liam Hupka made it 1-1 at 5:08, but 5 minutes later, Gridden's goal put Muskegon up a goal once again. Ty Hansen brought the Musketeers even at 53 of the third, but Kroll scored the deciding goal when he tallied at 12:21. Sioux City goalie Samuel Urban had 24 stops. And we'll now move from sports to Dear Abby and our first letter. I grew up in a big, lower-class family in which there has always been drama, fights, gossip, etc. I made a vow to myself that when I had my own family, I would raise them better. I keep myself and my children distanced from all of that. Am I wrong for keeping them away from my family? I don't like drama or problems. Sometimes I miss my family, but after a while, I get overwhelmed. Signed, Separate in Chicago. And the response. As a parent, your responsibility is to protect your children. If you feel exposing them to something might be harmful, you are within your rights to keep them away. However, if you are raising your children in a healthy environment, exposing them to your family drama in limited doses isn't likely to be harmful. Afterward, if your relatives behave badly, use it as a teaching moment. Use them as a bad example and point out that in your family, you do not behave. And then our next letter. I am a single man who recently turned 40. I am looking to find a wife who, like myself, has never been married and has no kids. I joined several dating websites, but most of the women are divorced or widowed or have kids. I just discovered a new dating site for single, never married people. I'm not sure if I should join it, but having a website designed for people like me is a great idea. I have read that 25% of all Americans have never been married. Pew Research just reported a brand new poll, and millions of Americans have never been married. So I am not losing hope. Should I join? Signed, Contemplating in Florida. And Abby responds, by all means, explore that new dating site. When you do, expect to meet people who are considerably younger than you. Remember, however, that once you connect, you will have to take all of the precautions that people on other sites do to ensure that you do not get misled. Dating, regardless of how you meet someone, can be risky. I wish you luck. And our next letter. I have a neighbor who lives across the street. She is in her late 70s. We have been friendly until recently when she came to visit with me for coffee. We talked about many different things that day. She had brought me a present and homemade cookies, which was nice. When I mentioned something that apparently she did not like or believe, she stood up, announced that she did not come over to feel uncomfortable, and left in a huff. I emailed her and sent a handwritten apology, but she hasn't spoken to me since. What should I do with her unopened gift and cookies? I don't feel comfortable accepting them. Signed, Dazed and Confused. And the response. How sad that your neighbor wasn't able to tell you what it was you said that made her so uncomfortable she felt she had to end the relationships. Perhaps you could have straightened it out at the time. However, her decision seems to have been made and you will have to accept it. Because you are now feeling uncomfortable accepting them, return her gift and the cookie. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 26th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.